evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 374, side 2, February the 2nd, 1979. The real answer to what happened to Nelson Rockefeller lies in this Megan Marshak. If she's a typical, as I say, a boiler room girl, whether he even knew her, whether this woman was just called in for the evening, for the hour, to service Nelson Rockefeller, and she ended up with a corpse and didn't know who he was, or whether she was actually working with him on a book, or whether she was sent there from somebody else to do a job, or whether they delayed calling the ambulance to make sure he was dead, or till she got dressed. There's a lot of unknown factors here, but a wonderful way to get rid of Nelson Rockefeller, if somebody wanted to get rid of him, would be to have it happen with a woman, because then the news media totally blacks it out in deference for the widow, et cetera, et cetera. And the stories of Chappaquiddick happened to keep Ted Kennedy from running from office. In that case, a woman had died. Well, in this case, Nelson died. But I think there are too many discrepancies in the story of where he died, who he was with, how he died. Now, all of those could be done to save the fact that instead of going home at night, he went to 54th Street, another home. His family was somewhere else, and had a woman and dropped dead. And they dropped dead of a heart attack, and he was caught. That's all. No big conspiracy. The only problem is the immediate cremation of a body, the lack of an autopsy, the fact that nobody knew he had a heart condition, that they can bend the law any way they want, and that Ms. Marshak, as of this date, has not been photographed, seen, or interviewed. If she was not an agent put in there, say, for purposes of getting rid of Nelson Rockefeller, she was actually a friend of a family or just a woman caught in a circumstance, I'm sure the news media would find her and photograph her and have some press interview. After all, this is a prominent family, and she was with Nelson Rockefeller when he dropped dead. And there's been a total news blackout, and there was a news blackout from the time he died. It was an unstory sometimes have to be looked into. And when this Mr. Shaw had this paid advertisement that nobody is safe if we don't investigate assassinations, he's perfectly right. And I don't think that there should be no autopsies and cremations so rapidly of public figures who do affect the course of the history, and they're going to affect your life, the air you breathe, and the world that you live in many, many ways that too numerous to list here. Well, one of the staunchest supporters of the Rockefellers, one of the big mouths of history, one of the most rotten journalists, James Reston of the great New York Times, had his usual words to say for Nelson Rockefeller that were syndicated Wednesday, January 31st, but he wrote them after the death of Nelson and before the name Megan Marshank came into the news, and or else he wouldn't have written them. So I want to share these with you just to show you how the news media is so maudlin and idiotic and sickening. I share a couple of sentences. He begins, "A worker to the end, Rockefeller never achieved his dreams." And then he says, this is James Reston, "It should probably remember that Nelson Rockefeller died at his desk on Friday night after almost everybody else had gone home for the weekend. He was a worker, a yearner, a builder to the end." You know, this great American hero. "He was not working when he died on the struggles, achievements, or disappointments of his political life, but on the consoling influence of art, beauty, and personal life." I don't think James Reston knew how right that was. And he was working on his personal life. And he has a quotation of Nelson Rockefeller who said, in quotes, "I think there's so much tension and pressure in the world that one gets tired and short-tempered, and if you can come back at the end of the day to an environment of beauty that has an important effect on one's tranquility and sense of peace, and to me, beauty and love are very closely related. Love is by far the most powerful force in the world," end quote. Well, love it was, and it was such a powerful force, he keeled over dead. But he had a wife and five children that he left in 1963, and married happy, and she gave up her four children to her husband and left custody of them and didn't raise them, so they had abandoned. This was nine children between them, and then they had two more children of their own. There is one more subtle possible motive. There are many for the reason that Rockefeller could be done at this time. And that has to do with the large story in San Francisco of Rockefeller buying on the West Coast, investing money in property, and working with a certain team and alliance in the San Francisco politics that built this controversial Pier 39 that is now under investigation, this large shopping center down on the wharf down there, as opposed to the Italian mafia organizations headed, well, I call them the Intertel Group versus the Mafia Group, the same kind of conflict that took place in Las Vegas when the user organization moved in and kicked out a certain element of organized crime to take over the turf there. The Alioto area that former mayor of San Francisco controlled, he had shipping lines that went bankrupt. There's lawsuits involved in that. And there is a power struggle of various people in that city, Ben Swig and Cyril Magnin and Pearsons that built this Pier 39, it's Mr. Simmons, versus the Alioto group, the Fisherman's Wharf territory. San Francisco is in a great state of turmoil. Dan White owned property, not didn't own, leased his potato restaurant from Pier 39. That's the man that killed Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. And Dianne Feinstein became the mayor of San Francisco because these other two people had been murdered. And she works with the Magnin, Ben Swig, Charles Gaines, chief of police, Rockefeller interests in San Francisco. So there's a conflict, a war going on at the highest levels there for covering, in simple words, what I call words, the turf of the city. And I had predicted that some more big people would be killed in this conflict. And of course, nobody in the major media, nobody at all, is mentioning the possibility of the Rockefeller investments in San Francisco or the Rockefeller investments in Jonestown territory next door, the Venezuela connections. These things have to be charted out very carefully, but San Francisco, most of the people, the home base from San Francisco for Jonestown, if it was a government experimental place or a place for training assassins and so forth, with its escape routes in Venezuela, had to have some connections to Rockefeller investments in Venezuela. There's a can of worms here that I'm not going to delineate right down to the nth degree, but I did predict that there would be deaths of some more people involved in the San Francisco scene, and because the Rockefellers had invested on the West Coast, this just recently bought the largest turkey farm in the United States up here near Santa Rosa, I believe, the Rockefellers. So some of them began moving west, and this may have something to do with why Rockefeller's control is diminished, and now they're down to brother David Rockefeller. There was also a cousin that died, another Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller, Nelson D. Rockefeller, died 2 days before Nelson in New York died. And this Nelson Rockefeller was a friend of Art Cherry's. He died at a veterans hospital in Palo Alto January 24th, 2 days before Nelson Rockefeller died. Just another one of those coincidences. Art knew this Nelson, and the other Nelson was his first cousin, I believe. And just before he died, his last letter to me, Art Cherry asked me why I killed both Rockefeller brothers, suggesting, of course, in jest, that these people were done in. And the coincidences continue, but one died at this end, one cousin, and the other one died in New York City. I'm sure that many of you saw the program Operation Mind Control that was on ABC nationwide. It got a lot of publicity this week, and they showed different centers where mind control experiments were done. They mentioned in Montreal, McGill University there, and Tulane University, and they had a tower of Berkeley campus, and they just briefly said at universities, and Boston Hospital, and there was a scene of Dr. Delgado's famous bulls being controlled by electrodes. For those of you who haven't seen that broadcast, I have covered a lot of that in various tape cassettes, and it wasn't new information for those of you who have followed my tape, so I won't go over it again. One interesting point that they did make on this particular broadcast was that James Angleton, of the Central Intelligence Agency, who was the agent in charge of counterintelligence, was very anxious to use hypnosis on agents, and they showed the Manchurian candidate and the attempts of the Central Intelligence Agency to create persons who could do political assassinations and have their memories erased. And if you have the two tapes I did last week on John Paisley and the week before, I mentioned that James Jesus Angleton headed the assassination teams and was chief of counterintelligence, and that he was the man not only who worked with John Paisley since 1948, but hinted in 1974 when he officially left the CIA about the assassination of John Kennedy, that he wasn't privy to who shot John. But there were hypnotists involved in the various assassinations that Angleton has been involved in. At Jack Ruby's nightclub, there was a man named Billy Del Mar, a hypnotist, who could have had control of Jack Ruby and coaxed him to do the shootings. Billy Del Mar was never called as a witness. He fled Dallas after the assassination of John Kennedy. And also, Jack Ruby was in the touch with David Ferry from New Orleans and the assassination teams. And it was Jack Ruby who right away was very proud that he had shot Lee Harvey Oswald, the man who was the alleged assassin of John Kennedy, because he believed that he would be a hero and everyone would love him. He was told that. And he was quite proud of what he did until he realized that he was trapped. And of course, there's been many references to the mind washing and erasing of Sirhan Sirhan, and that he would like to go back to the scene of the ambassador to reconstruct what happens, because he doesn't know what happened. And he's been under deep hypnosis ever since Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And Arthur Bremer shot George Wallace and has this silly grin on his face, and has never been studied in terms of being hypnotized to get to Laurel, Maryland, to the shopping center to find out where George Wallace was going to be, and then to be taken away as a zombie. James Earl Ray's head seems clear on this matter. He doesn't seem to be hypnotized like the others. Reverend Dumke was on radio and television this week talking about Patty Hearst and her release, and she was released yesterday from the federal prison. And in my article, The SLA is the CIA, I believe that I was the first person in the country to publish the fact that Patty Hearst had been given a substance that she called a pill when she made that tape to her parents, and that this pill could change and alter her entire personality and put her under a victim of mind control. And in the article I wrote called The SLA is the CIA, some of you have it, and if you don't have, you can write to me and order it. It's a dollar plus the postage, which is now about 30 cents for the postage. In that article, I talked about the UCLA Institute for the Study and Prevention of Violence, and that the basis of trying to analyze the members of the SLA who were so potentially violent would be reason enough to continue that UCLA school that I was worried about, and that I believe then was the basis for the experimentations down in Jonestown. What I wrote in 1974, in the summer of 74, in this article was, in quotes, "a carefully guarded secret has been the massive brain experimentation and hypnosis programs taking place in prisons and mental hospitals for the past 15 years. And I referred to different medications which were administered, double doses were given for no reason, which caused distinct changes in personalities. Over the past year, I wrote, I have been accumulating evidence of mind-altering methods and how they pertain to the past political assassinations. The U.S. has financed psychosurgical experiments in Boston by Dr. Mark, Irvin, and Sweet. That's the surgery that I referred to last week on the tape of Leonard Keeley. I said, they're now spreading around the country, these doctors, with plans that exist to turn large masses of the population into zombies to be used for future slave labor and kamikaze war troops. Prisoners are the experimental scapegoats. And in this article, I referred to Dr. Delgado, funded by NASA. That's the space agency that brought over Nazi doctors after World War II, and Navy intelligence. And their purpose is to control behavior through implanted electrodes. This is being done at the present time at Vacaville Medical Facility, Atascadero Hospital in California. And I have a quotation there that was in the congressional record of Dr. Delgado, talking about physical control of the mind, that man does not have the right to develop his own mind. Now, in 74 in my article, the SLA is the CIA, or why was Patricia Hearst kidnapped? I want to repeat what I said, because the same institutions that I was fighting in 73 and trying to expose in 74, it seems, were the institutions that moved down to Jonestown. And what I said, there was a double purpose for the experimentations that were going on. A, turn large masses of the population into zombies to be used for future slave labor. And the second thing would be the kamikaze war troops. After the 910 people were killed in Jonestown, there was talk of Terry Buford and other people that assassins were out loose, and we figured out that there are at least 120 minimum to 210 that are still out loose. There was talk by the very persons involved that these people were trained assassins, and there was a doctor from Tulane University that went down there right away to be with those so-called defectors or survivors from Tulane, that it was important in the electrode and LSD experiments, who said that various assassins have been brainwashed and that they were trained down in Jonestown. Now, one of the new books out on the Mellons, there's a new book out on the Mellon family, talks about their bauxite in Guyana and bringing persons, bring the bauxite up through Louisiana to various locations in the United States. But the nice thing about it was that there's long hours there, and they could have enclosed camps and keep the workers going. There was no control on the workers, and use slave labor in the bauxite mines, thus making the profits greater, so that they could train slave laborers who still were unaccounted for in Jonestown and assassins at the same time. And the two things that I was writing about in 1974 are just those things that were happening down in Jonestown in 1978. And what really bugs me about the Patty Hearst case is that when it became obvious that she was going to get out and that there were links of the SLA to the Central Intelligence Agency, links that I discussed in two tapes on Leo Chern and the Little Green Book and other tapes, as I say, are available in the past for you. What really bothers me is that as the evidence came in of who was behind the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, and I had met Reverend Dumke, who's been her advisor and friend, and people from the Patty Hearst Committee came down to the House for information. When the evidence was really strong on who was to blame for creating the whole SLA, then everybody who is part of this counterintelligence network responsible for it or close to it came in and became her saviors. Ruth Stapleton was with her the night before Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence and went down to see her and visited with her. And then Patty Hearst's fiancé said, "We'll name our first baby Jimmy Carter Shaw." Senator Hayakawa said, "Release her," even though he's tied up with the highest level of counterintelligence from Britain and international intelligence, and has been all of his life. Hayakawa said, "Release Patty Hearst." Charles Bates of the FBI said, "Release Patty Hearst," even though it was a COINTEL program under the direction of the FBI. And the Hearst family had the names of Dothard Perry and Mr. Lewis and men from the CIA, from both the CIA and FBI, who knew where she was all along, and the Pentagon knew where she was, and they were responsible for this charade. And they are agents. Emily William Harris know also their background in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, with the narcotic and intelligence squads. And the Charles Bates got into it, Hayakawa, Ruth Stapleton, and D.A. Browning, appointed by Richard Nixon, said, "Oh, she served enough." When it became obvious that the heat was on Patty Hearst's story, and the evidence was coming in loud and clear on both the mind control of Donald DeFries and the CIA connections of Colston Westbrook and Chris Thompson and the whole nucleus that formed the SLA, just like they formed Jonestown, this white entourage, you know, among the Berkeley scene of a extremely capable, well-trained intelligence operation. When that began to become evident to more people than, say, Jismay Bressel, then all of these people got in on the free Patty Hearst. "Come on, let her out, Jimmy, let her out." Not that she shouldn't be out, but Hayakawa and Stapleton and Bates and Browning and all of them. And the result is that Patty Hearst comes out, and thanks all of them for helping her get out, and says, I will have a military wedding because we can have seclusion. So a woman that was somewhat free before the kidnapping, who could make some decisions on her own, right or wrong, was taken away, kidnapped, altered, and then brought back to the straight life. Her husband is a policeman. He brought her a bulletproof vest to wear when she left the jail, the prison, federal prison. He's very expertise at karate, and they have a dog to protect them, and they can be married at a military location. But if this was, in fact, an intelligence operation, if she can provide any information about the Harrises, and even Reverend Dumke promised me and never gave me the Nazi connections to Emily William Harris and the Nazi indoctrinations of Patty Gaber, maybe I'll be able to meet her. She's written me a letter and thanked me for all that I've done. But if it is a high-level plot, and if she still knows too much, she's married to a cop who will take care of her, but she'll never be immune. There isn't any kind of a vest or suit or car that will protect her any more than Nelson Rockefeller or Pope John Paul I. There's no bodyguards or anybody that will protect Patty Hearst. I felt that all along that her protection was in asking through the courts how the SLA was formed. And if she was bumped off then, she'd be bumped off for a reason. But now she's going to fall into the arms of all the right-wing people who hushed up when she was kidnapped, who ignored her, the media that put her down and played up the kidnapping and not the brainwashing. And now she is going along with the idea that they are her saviors, which is okay, but I wouldn't want to be in her shoes, because if the whole thing doesn't come out, she can't be safe. And I think that she'll settle for just ending it and not exposing the roots of it. And the roots of the SLA are what need to be told, because the SLA was the baby of Jonestown, and Jonestown is just another monster before some other tragedy takes even more than 910. The similarities between the SLA and the Jonestown story are tremendous, and they're not coincidental. And if you study the SLA, get my article, which is book length, and read it carefully, and then take the research that I'm doing on Jonestown, you can see the overlays of the same people, the same doctors, the same motives that I stated then taking place now. And what I said when John Kennedy was killed was that if you didn't investigate John Kennedy's assassination, all other political elections could be run by the bullet and blackmail. And that's what is happening, and that's what that Mr. Shaw was saying on the ad. If you study any single one of the assassinations well, the seeds are planted for the next. And if you pass them up, you lose the opportunity to have your electoral system without these constant manipulations of murders. And you also lose the opportunity for a free life and free choices, because Jonestown was an experiment that's going to affect all of us. And if we don't investigate it, like we didn't investigate the SLA, and I asked 1,000 provocative questions in that article that nobody could answer and nobody cared to answer. Even the people that read it might have found it interesting and ordered more, but they didn't address themselves to the question. So what comes down next is another tragedy, and then on top of that, we get another tragedy. Mr. Baldwin, 94 years old, founder of the Civil Liberties Union, was on Good Morning America, and he was interviewed by David Hartman yesterday, and they asked him, what was the biggest disappointment in your life? And he said the biggest disappointment in his 94 years was the Soviet Union-Nazi pact just prior to World War II. He said the communists let him down, and that they made a pact with the worst dogs in the world, the Nazis, and then there was no peace, and the Nazis just had time to get stronger, and the war broke out full blast, and that was the biggest thing, tragedy in his life. And I think you should read the headlines and watch very carefully two big forces, in addition, three big forces of fascism building up, one Khomeini in Iran, and the other is Jimmy Carter signing pacts with Mr. Tang. The headline saying, China reiterates its warning on threat posed by the Soviet Union. That goes into that warm game plan of United States arming up with China against the Soviet Union. China and the United States signing their agreement, literally to gang up against the Soviet Union. This is a very dangerous thing, and it's something you should watch, the way it's building up and the way the same corporations, I have a list of the corporations that put on that affair at Kennedy Center the other night, the same corporations that funded Adolf Hitler funded the event for the visiting gentleman from Chinaman, who is now scolding the Soviet Union. At the same time this is taking place, Pope John Paul II, I call him the Pope from IG Farb and Auschwitz, is down in Mexico, and the throngs are there. The throngs in Iran, similar to the adoration Adolf Hitler had, and throngs down in Mexico. And this Pope, there's articles, the adoring crowd turns out for the Pope. Pope urges the Latin bishops to speak out against injustice. Another headline from the Examiner News, January the 28th, Pope cheered as he warns of Marxists. And there's a little contradiction there. He's worrying about the poor people, and he's visiting the Indians. The San Francisco Chronicle, January the 30th, Pope visits the poor Indians of Mexico. And the other paper on the 24th, he speaks out about injustice, and then he begins his anti-communist talk. The Pope warns you about the Marxists. If the Marxists were in Mexico, those people would have a house, a job, a medical place, facility for them, employment, health, without the narcotics, without organized crime, without the Central Intelligence Agency. And the Pope is there to speak this double talk. Be careful of Marxists, but I'm sorry, because you're poor. Pope John Paul was analyzed in the Washington Post, an article by Cyril Gilbert. John Paul III has shown a sterner militancy towards Marxism than did his namesakes. And they said several Italian observers said that the former Archbishop of Krakow ought to have called himself Pius XIII. Every week there are new people to begin taking these tape cassettes, and if they have already heard the information, I don't like to repeat it. And that's why I have to refer the new listeners back to tapes 362, 363, and 364. Those are the numbers that refer to how Pope John Paul II was selected. This pope is down in Mexico, and another story over the wire services came out, Associated Press. Pope tells the Latin bishops to stay out of politics. He says that his address to the people will be on social justice, spiritually, not politically, and this is important. He told the bishops, don't depict Christ as a political figure involved in a class struggle. The idea of Christ as a political figure doesn't tally with the church's catechesis. And he told them to beware of that. Don't think of Christ as political. I disagree with him entirely, and I think it's important in terms of political assassinations to realize that most of what we call assassinations are, in fact, political acts. There's a book that came out a few years ago called The Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft, and it begins with a very good point, which I want to share with you in light of what the Pope is trying to tell these people down there. It refers to the Gospel of St. John and the piercing of Christ with this spear that went through his ribs. The name of this soldier was Gaius Cassius, G-A-I-U-S, C-A-S-S-I-U-S. He attended the crucifixion as the official Roman representative for the proconsul Pontius Pilate. For 2 years, Cassius had followed the activities of a certain Jesus of Nazareth who claimed to be the Messiah, but he was undermining the authority of the Roman occupation of Israel. The Roman centurion watched the legionaries carry out the execution of Jesus Christ, and like them was impressed by his courage. But Annas, A-N-N-A-S, the aged advisor to the Sanhedrin, decided that they should put a spear into Jesus to prove that he was nothing but a heretic, a potential usurper of their own power, of their own political power, of the Roman political power. So they petitioned Pontius Pilate for the authority to break the limbs of the crucified men and put this spear through the ribs of Jesus Christ. And the spear did penetrate Jesus, and the book is about that spear and where it went and what happened to it. But the fact is that the Romans were doing nothing but exploiting other people's territory, other people who were not warmongering. Israel wasn't armed in those days, and they were minding their own business in that country way back when. And the Romans were off conquering, just like this country conquers Iran. They say, we want your oil. Here, put in the Shah for 25 years. Here's the Savak. Here's the weapons. Here's the torture house. Let us pump our oil. Political assassinations have been around for a long, long time. And the way to end them, I think, is to expose the profits that are gained by those people during the murders. And if we don't expose them, then the killings keep going on and on. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. I'll be back with you next week. So stay well and happy, and be back together next Friday. Art Cherry used to have champagne every night, 2 glasses of champagne, when Avis came home from work. So this song is for Art Cherry.